Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. I'll be keeping you company here on News Talk for the next hour or so as we look at some of the big stories making the news here in Ireland and all around the world in business and in politics. Coming up on today's show, France is in turmoil. We're going to get the latest from Sarah Collins of the Business Post about what's happening there and where it will all end. And sticking with Europe, make Europe great again as the EU adopts a Europe first policy. Alice Hancock is the EU correspondent with the Financial Times, and she'll be joining me later in the show to discuss how Europe is future proofing for the impending arrival of Donald Trump in January. And with much talk of coalitions here after our own elections last week, Mick Clifford of The Examiner will be joining me to look at how coalition governments work. And we're going to be looking at some of the historic coalitions in the past, which have been good and bad. So if you want to get in contact with us, you can do so at takingstock@newstalk.com, or we're open at X@StockNT. So just how should the EU deal with a round of trade wars and tariffs? With the return of President Trump just weeks away now, it's a topic that's exercising the minds of the EU Commission, particularly its Vice President Stéphane Sojourné. Alice Hancock is the EU correspondent with the Financial Times, and she joins me now to discuss. Alice, you're very welcome along to News Talk.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Now, we've just had an election campaign here in Ireland, Alice, and we spent the last 2 weeks of the campaign talking about an impending storm cloud gathering over Ireland, courtesy of Donald Trump. As you know, we've got lots of US multinationals here. And what I wanted to do today is get a sense of what that feeling is like in Europe. Maybe give us a sense of how the EU and the Commission in particular, I suppose, are looking at Trump's return in January.
I mean, it would be wrong to say they're not worried. Of course, the key thing that all EU officials will tell you is that while we have some idea of what a Trump presidency is promising, and he has done it before, after all, we don't know exactly. I mean, he's made lots of statements on the campaign trail. But of course, with Trump, we have to see what translates from what he says and what he tweets to what actually happens on the ground. I mean, of course, there's good reason, as you point out, to be worried, Ireland not least. The EU runs some $131 billion trade deficit with the US. You know, the US is the EU's largest trading partner for exports of goods, second largest for imports of goods. Actually, Italy and Ireland, I think, are among those with the biggest deficit. So, you know, of course, if the minute Trump starts to talk about whacking tariffs on things, the EU should rightly be worried. And especially also this threat of putting 60% tariffs on Chinese goods, because there is already an issue with a sort of quotes flood of cheaper Chinese imports coming into the EU. And that is undermining EU industry. And that is something that's really giving officials in the Commission quite a lot to think about.
Yeah, we don't really know what Trump 2.0 is going to be like, but we can kind of get a sense from the appointments that he's made, how decisive he is this time, I think, and how quickly he is doubling down on those comments about tariffs. But I'm frequently, you know, reminded by many commentators that he doesn't seem to really understand that they can also hurt him and the American people terribly. Is there any sense that it's dissipating in any way from his perspective?
I mean, it's a tough call to make. It will. We've already seen pushback from the Mexican president against this. They've had a phone call. He's put things on Canada. So yeah, you're already beginning to see sort of cracks and wondering how this will play out. Brussels is taking a sort of more conciliatory tone to it. We had an interview with Christine Lagarde, head of the European Central Bank, in the FT recently, and she was saying, you know, Europe needs to negotiate with Trump. We need to take this conciliatory tone. The European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen has already floated buying more US natural gas, which could help replace some of the volumes still coming from Russia. It could buy more US defense technology, agricultural products. But, you know, there are carrots, of course, but they are probably also sticks. I'm sure that in the Commission, they're already thinking up, you know, what things they might hit back with. And of course, last time around, we saw the EU imposing tariffs on things like bourbon and Harley Davidson. So there are going to be impacts, as you say, for the US citizens too.
It's interesting just watching over the last couple of months, Ursula von der Leyen, when she was reappointed, Mario Draghi as well. The, you know, if the last term in her in office for her was all about climate and the Green Deal, it's been replaced by competitiveness now. So constantly hearing from the EU about this drive for competitiveness. And I guess that's where the add-on Europe First is starting to come. Big upheaval in France this week and instability and of political turmoil also in Germany. Maybe just talk us through a little bit about why that competitiveness issue is so prevalent in the narrative of people like Ursula von der Leyen at the moment.
Yeah, it's so interesting this. I think if you'd been here in 2019, there was this sort of flood of green enthusiasm. There was the Fridays for Future movement. We had the announcement of the EU Green Deal and the so-called Fit for 55 files, which are things like, you know, this famous 2035 ban on combustion engines and bringing in more houses and so on into the emissions trading system, and all these things designed to cut emissions. And I think all these targets were set. A huge amount of bureaucracy comes with that for companies, a lot of reporting requirements. And they were set in a different age. They were set in an age before there was war in Ukraine, before COVID, before a more protectionist China, you know, all these things. And now people are thinking, oh my God, we didn't actually set these targets thinking, how is the industry actually going to get there? Are they going to work in practice? And what the Draghi report really pointed out was that actually, no, we need to really address things like high energy prices. I mean, electricity prices in Germany, for example, are up 60% year to date. And that's even after we've sort of had the energy crisis in 2022-23. And as I said, EU industry is being undercut by cheaper Chinese imports, which are, they're not only benefiting from cheap labor and subsidies and planned economy and so on. They're actually good. You know, if you buy a Chinese electric car, it's a decent bit of kit. So there's a lot of challenges coming at the EU, which are sort of layered underneath this very ambitious climate agenda, which is admirable from the point of view of cutting emissions. But for industry, it's very difficult. So it's been interesting to see that now one of the sort of landmark bits of legislation that will be put forward by Brussels in the first 100 days of this new European Commission mandate, which started this week, is a so-called Clean Industrial Deal. So if you think back in 2019, we had the Green Deal, now we have the Clean Industrial Deal. It's all about industry. It's all about improving the economy and stopping the job cuts, which are coming in their tens of thousands if the car companies and steel companies be believed.
Yeah, it's interesting. You've been writing about the new industry, I think he's the Vice President of the European Commission, Stéphane Séjourné. He's French and close to Macron, I hear, but he has this Europe First policy, and he's saying in this, in the piece that you wrote, that, you know, sustainable energy, climate, that's you know, all very good, but we can't have any of that, cars, wind farms, without steel. So it is that kind of more common sense approach to delivering jobs and business, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, what I thought was fascinating this week was that ArcelorMittal, the big steel manufacturer, last week they said they were going to put on hold a decision to make significant billions of investment in the EU in electric arc furnaces and so on, which would hugely help decarbonize. But also, you know, that's jobs, that's good levels of investment. So they put that decision on hold. And on Tuesday this week, the Belgian Prime Minister, plus Séjourné and Thérèse Ribéry, who is another Executive Vice President of the European Commission, all turned up to the ArcelorMittal steel plant in Belgium, all sort of saying nice things about European industry and how we're going to cut bureaucracy. And they're also particularly also worried by the introduction of a new carbon border tax on emissions from 2026 on steel. And so it was fascinating to see that level of high sort of caliber politician all arriving at this one steel plant to sort of say, hey, don't worry, you know, stick with it. And Séjourné's brief is really to oversee that sort of change of position in the commission, to make sure that it's listening to industry, to make sure that it's putting in place policies that will help industry both decarbonize. I mean, the commission is very adamant that it will stick with its targets, but remain globally competitive. And that is exactly what this Clean Industrial Deal hopefully will be about.
It's interesting, isn't it? Because this is the type of problem that a lot of big, large companies trying to do business in Europe have been complaining about for years now. The, you know, heavy regulatory environment, the bureaucracy, the absolutely, you know, mind-numbing impossibility of getting through some of the systems. And actually, they're trying to lift those now because of the threat of what is a protectionist economic model coming in at them. But are they not themselves, you know, promoting a Europe first? And that's protectionist in itself.
Yeah, it's so funny to sort of see this region that grew up on multilateralism and free trade start to take a far more protectionist stance. And I mean, as you said, Séjourné is, he's French, who are famous for promoting a more sort of bi-European viewpoint. But I mean, you're seeing it across the block, and you're seeing it not only from the right wing, you're seeing it from liberal politicians and more from the left as well. And I think, as you say, the simplification agenda is a huge part of what needs to happen in terms of trying to encourage investment in the EU and so forth. Because I mean, the big risk here is that, you know, Trump or even Elon Musk, I suppose, as he's in charge of cutting red tape in the US, go on a sort of regulatory slash and burn. Certainly politicians of the more right wing, who are already challenging the EU's administratively heavy green agenda, say, hey, you know, why don't we do a bit more of what they're doing? We need to cut reporting requirements. We need to revise some of the sort of emission standards for cars, make it easier for industry, and be less ambitious on climate.
Well, Trump is, you know, transactional at best, let's just say that. And his preference is those one-to-one kind of deals that he can create himself, can take ownership of. And I'm just wondering, from that perspective, like, what do you think the relationship with the EU could be like? Do you think that he is of a mind to do separate deals with individual countries? Or do you think he wants to negotiate as a bloc with them? Or do you think that they're just not on his radar in terms of a place to do business? I was very interested that you mentioned Ursula von der Leyen, you know, maybe buying some LNG for them as an antidote to their our energy crisis, but also I suppose a sop to him to say, you know, we've got supply issues here, we can buy some of your product. But, you know, do you think that, you know, an EU bloc like that, that is kind of cumbersome, bureaucratic, that suits the kind of Donald Trump model of let's do business?
Well, no, exactly. I think that's one of the critical fears of the EU, is that, you know, Trump tries to do bilateral deals and sort of breaks them apart. I think, you know, one of the key things that came out of a big meeting of leaders in Budapest just shortly after Trump was elected was this idea that we must hold unity, we must stay unified. But it's very difficult when you have leaders like Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban or Robert Fico in Slovakia, who are quite happy to court Trump. And they you know, present themselves as more sort of pro-Trump, even pro-Russia in some cases, leaders, which are, you know, quite different to the rest of the EU. There's also concerns, of course, that Trump will try and target the UK as well, to sort of single that away at a time when the UK is trying to integrate itself more with the EU and sort of quotes reset relations post-Brexit. So there's a lot of worry about fragmentation, and it'll be an interesting test of the EU's integration itself. You know, how it responds to Trump.
What do you think, Alice, about, you know, potential volatility in, say, financial markets? It's very unpredictable, and the trade policies, the foreign policies, the geopolitical kind of nightmare that's ongoing at the moment. You know, do you think that there's a worry in the markets that this might be a time of instability that we're going into?
I mean, I think you see it already, probably even without Trump. I mean, you mentioned the problems in France at the moment. The Barnier government fell after the shortest term in office. That French markets are, you know, all over the place. Markets are definitely worried. But on the other hand, perhaps they have a bit better sense of what is coming. As I said, you know, we have had a Trump presidency before. So maybe investors know what to look for. And I think on the general, I mean, he's a pro-business kind of guy. You said, he likes to do deals. So if you can capitalize on those deals, then that's good for you in terms of business. But on the, I do think it, yes, it will be volatile. It's unpredictable. That is the roller coaster that a Trump presidency is.
It certainly is. Look, I think if there is, I'm trying to find some plus sides, but if there is some plus sides, you've mentioned a couple of times that we've been here before. He, you know, this is his second term in office. He'll be more familiar with what's required on the international stage for sure. But I think the winners might be those who can adapt quickly to a changing and very movable feast that is Donald Trump. As you said, we very often get his policies on Twitter. I'm just not sure that the European bloc is an agile, and by its very nature, it's consensus driven, is agile enough to deal with those things. And I definitely don't think it dealt with them well in the past. But now, if it's a trade war where he's moving very quickly on things, you know, and two of the big powerhouses themselves likely to have political instability for many, many months to come, because I think the German election isn't until February, and I don't think France can have elections until the middle of next year. You know, that's not good, is it, that those two big powerhouses themselves are in a state of flux?
No, absolutely. I completely agree. I think it's very difficult. As you say, Brussels and the wider EU, it's not a nimble place, because that's what it is when you have 27 member states to govern and you've got to try and agree a legislation between all of them. Mm. And that obviously plays to Trump's strengths, because then, you know, if you want to respond quickly to Trump, you want to do something bilateral where it's your national government and you can do something quickly. There is a huge concern about France and Germany having such instability. And, you know, you are beginning to see smaller countries forming sort of coalitions amongst themselves. We had a very interesting talk with the Czech transport minister today, who they're pushing for easing of the rules around emission standards for cars, because they're very worried, of course, that all these car manufacturers are laying off lots of jobs and that they will have to pay huge fines from next year for not meeting emission standards because they're simply not selling enough electric vehicles. But he was saying, you know, we tried to get France and Germany on board with our ideas to sort of cut these penalties and so on. But we just can't, because they don't really have stable governments at the moment. But they are building a coalition with Italy, with other countries in Central and Eastern Europe. And they are trying to sort of create critical masses without these two big players.
Interesting. There was an American delegation of kind of like a trade mission over here a couple of months ago, very pro-Trump supporters. And I asked them, they were looking around Europe to do business. What was the main thing they wanted to get when they were visiting different member states as a way to kind of, you know, convince them to invest? And they said, we have to feel wanted and we have to feel the system will respond to us. But I think that that's a very interesting challenge for the EU, because there's so many regulations, so much red tape and bureaucracy and difficulties to get through. It's very hard to unpick if you're trying to navigate a new kind of climate of tariffs and trade agreements.
Yeah, exactly. That's so interesting. As you say, that, you know, the EU is not set up for this. And I do think also, you know, there are things like the EU needs capital markets union. That's a long running thing that is yet to be agreed, may not be. But it also needs to take a more venture capital attitude. You know, I really feel like the EU probably needs to start spinning a more positive, maybe even take a more American attitude to how it does things. And, you know, we have an excellent quality of life in the EU, and we have some of the most, you know, highest levels of education, all these things. And to be a bit more positive about that and try and encourage investment in that way may be something that we should think about, even when it feels like dark days ahead.
Absolutely. Look, and as you say, look, we enjoy a very privileged life here, and it's an excellent place to live. Maybe not always a brilliant place to do business. We're just trying to highlight the challenges. Alice, I did want to talk to you about digital services. I did want to talk to you about energy, but alas, time is upon us, so we're going to have to leave it there. But I really do appreciate you taking the time to come and explain all that to us today. That was Alice Hancock, EU correspondent with the Financial Times. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks so much.
Coming up next, France is in turmoil. We'll take a look at why it's happening as they join a growing number of EU member states in political flux. Don't go anywhere. Welcome back to News Talk's Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, French politicians have ousted their government with a no-confidence motion, an unprecedented move which plunges the Eurozone's second biggest economy deeper into political turmoil. So what is coming up next for them? Well, I'm joined now by Sarah Collins, who's the Brussels correspondent with the Business Post. Sarah, you're very welcome to Taking Stock. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks.
Now, we might start, Sarah, by reminding ourselves about the government itself, how it came to be, because France went to the polls earlier this year, a bit of a gamble that Macron took. And that government that Michel Barnier took up the position for, it was only in September. So, but you might just take us back to the Macron thing. Why did he do what he did when he did it?
Yeah, it was a surprise election. It was just after the European vote when it looked like the National Rally, the far right party, had won. Macron decided that they would be too unwieldy if they had power in the European Parliament. So he decided to call a snap election and try to cement his own majority. Mm. It didn't work. The National Rally did win a lot of the votes. They were the biggest single party that was elected in that election in July. The thing is, though, there was this left alliance that formed to kind of oppose them. The left together got more seats, but separately in their individual parties, not enough to form a majority government. So we find ourselves, or Macron found himself, trying to nominate a prime minister that would appeal to both sides. Not easy. He came up with Michel Barnier as a compromise, who formed a minority government, which wasn't popular with either side of the house. What looks like happened was, this was ostensibly now a fight about the budget, but it looks like it's essentially a way to try to scalp Macron himself. And both sides of the house are now calling for his resignation, as well as toppling Michel Barnier this week.
Then just how unprecedented, Sarah, is this?
This hasn't happened in over 60 years. The last time there was a no confidence vote that went through and a government fell was in 1962. Georges Pompidou, he has this amazing building named after him in Paris. He was prime minister at the time. Charles de Gaulle was president. And it was seen as an attempt. There was a lot of stuff going on in France at the time, internal politics. Charles de Gaulle was trying to put forward a referendum to make the president elected directly, which he won. And that government fell, but it actually cemented power for de Gaulle and Pompidou. And they went on to become to remain prime minister and president for a long time. And Pompidou eventually then became president. This is not the same situation at all.
No. And you mentioned there that Michel Barnier had no easy task ahead of him. But as a figure, like, he was very well respected for exactly that, and navigating very choppy, difficult waters during Brexit. Like, if he can't assuage those kind of concerns, and if he can't bring those people together, like, who can?
You know, it's really interesting. I don't think Irish people can ever understand how different French politics is. Mm. They do not do consensus politics. They do not do coalitions. It's just not in their nature. You know, political scientists have told me it's just so unprecedented because of that. Mm. Barnier was, he's really well known in France, but more well known outside of France, especially in Ireland, for being that consensus builder on Brexit. But when he came in to try to bring the two extremes of the French National Assembly together, it was an impossible task. I think he probably knew it at the time. Macron tried, but Barnier's party is just seen as too toxic to both the left and the far right. They see him as, you know, the left sees him as too conservative. The right sees him as, you know, a party of the establishment. Mm. And they believe that a new force, a new energy is needed in French politics. And they both believe that they're the ones to be that force.
Now, you say, and you're probably right about this, that it's actually, in effect, not really about the budget. It's about politics, and it's about using the budget and Barnier and everything that comes with it to ultimately get back at Macron. But that austerity budget that he brought in, which was recommending or including 60 billion in tax hikes and spending cuts, why was that necessary?
So France has traditionally been a bigger spender than, say, you know, Germany, the bloc's biggest economy. They've, you know, tried hard to control deficits. Macron, when he came in 2017, his presidential campaign, he campaigned on a ticket of being, you know, an anti-establishment force, but also like a liberal force that would help to control the deficit. And he managed in the first couple of years, he did manage to cut the deficit. It came down below EU limits for the first time in, I think, about 10 years. And then the pandemic hit. And he also, you know, he forced through labor reforms and he forced through pension reforms that have continued to be extremely unpopular. Pandemic and the energy crisis, it just blew apart his deficit reduction plan. And the deficit and the debt as a result have just been climbing up ever since. Now the deficit is at twice the EU's limit. It's not going to get down even under Barnier's, you know, slash and burn austerity budget. Was not going to get down below the EU limit till 2029. The debt is now twice the country's GDP. It is still climbing. And the problem with this budget crisis now is that if the markets do hammer France, those debt repayments go up. Mm. You know, if investors demand more of a premium on to buy their bonds, that means debt goes up. Yeah. So it has plunged France into an economic crisis as well as a political one.
And what impact is it having on the markets in France? And could we see a weakening of the euro as a result of this?
So far, it's been pretty tame. Mm. I mean, we saw during the week that bond spreads did widen. Investors are now essentially treating French debt the way they would treat Greek debt. But French debt is still not as expensive as Italian debt, for example, or British debt. The thing that's worrying some observers is that, you know, they're looking to what happened in the UK when a budget crisis effectively toppled Liz Truss's government and sent UK bond spreads, you know, skyrocketing. But again, so far, like EU officials I've spoken to are worried because it's France. It's the second biggest economy. But they do look to the French machinery of state as a kind of stabilizing force. Mm. Even Michel Barnier said in his statement when he handed in his resignation on Thursday, he said, you know, things will continue. They have a special way of, you know, they can take the budget from 2024, divide it into 12ths and go month by month. So it's not ideal, but things can sort of motor ahead in a certain way.
Mm, there's a core stability there that the markets are factoring in about France in a way that they wouldn't about Greece or Italy or even us at some point. But look, it's very interesting because of what's also happening in Germany. So now we have, you know, two massive political powerhouses of the EU in fundamental political flux at the same time. What actually happens now, Sarah? Like, you know, Barnier said it'll be okay, we'll bring in a budget. Like, what do they do? As I understand it, they don't have elections, or they can't have elections for quite some time to come.
No, and they can't have elections for a year after the previous one. So the previous one finished in July, so they can't have another one until June, July next year. It means Macron has to appoint a prime minister that can manage to sort of stay the course for the next 6 months. That is, at this point, looking really, really difficult. There were a couple of politicians who were seen going into the Élysée Palace today to meet Macron. So he is trying. He's already, you know, moving forward. What happens with the budget is, it looks the most likely thing is that the 2024 budget will carry over. So they'll go month by month. A prime minister needs to be appointed. They will then need to form a government. The problem is that the makeup of the National Assembly hasn't changed. Mm. Marine Le Pen's far-right party still holds the most seats. The left coalition of a bunch of different parties, including La France Insoumise, France Unbowed, which is led by this firebrand Jean-Luc Mélenchon, is still one of the bigger parties, along with the communists and the socialists. And none of those parties agree on who should be prime minister. They all want their own people at the top. So it's just looking very, very difficult. And this could be a pattern that repeats itself. A prime minister is appointed, they last for a couple of months, they fall again. Mm. I mean, let's see. The French did need to approve a budget by the end of this year. But again, there are ways and means around that.
And any names, Sarah, as to who the likely next prime minister might be?
It's absolutely anyone's guess. Apparently, according to French media, a couple of people were seen going into the Élysée Palace this week. François Bayrou, he's a former presidential candidate. He's head of a centrist democratic movement, which could be kind of appealing. He's not an extreme candidate for either side. Bernard Cazeneuve, another former prime minister, He was a socialist, but he left the party when they went into this leftist alliance this summer. He was seen going in. Other names that the French media is talking about, former finance minister François Baroin and Bruno Retailleau, who's the interior minister, but both of them are from the same party as Barnier. And it's certainly the interior minister, Retailleau, is seen as very, very right wing. Another name, apparently Ségolène Royal, she's a socialist. She was a former presidential candidate. She wrote to Macron, according to the French media, offering her services. And Lucie Castets, who's the head of this new Popular Front, the leftist alliance that together won the most seats in the summer. She wanted to be prime minister this summer. She's a civil servant and economist. It doesn't look like she would be acceptable, though, at all.
And just again to go back to the Germany thing and the political difficulties they're having and how this might kind of manifest itself and cause instability in Europe. And we were talking earlier on about the Europe First policy that's going on at the centre of Ursula von der Leyen's cabinet now about competitiveness and all of that kind of stuff. But this does nothing to stabilise the EU movement ahead of Trump's impending return, does it?
No, and it's one of the real problems now for the EU. I mean, the European Commission has taken office and von der Leyen has cemented power herself. But if she doesn't have the agreement of Germany and France on an economic program, on a defense program, on a migration program, it makes her life very difficult. It makes the EU's kind of big plans for the future and its new budget extremely difficult to agree. That budget is due to be tabled next summer. So let's see what happens there. But the German economy is also it's absolutely stagnating and has been for many years. There's an election coming up there, so we're effectively in stasis for the next couple of months. And it's anybody's guess who will end up in that coalition government in Germany. So, I mean, the bloc's two big economic powerhouses are effectively defenestrated for a number of months, and it makes life very difficult.
But is this situation in France now, is it actually about the rise of the right, or is it more about Macron himself and just that feeling that, you know, he can't actually get a critical mass to do the things that he wants to do? He's just too unpopular. That gamble did not pay off last year for him.
It is a little bit from column A, a little bit from column B. You know, across Europe, there was a lot of right-leaning parties elected. The European Parliament, for example, sort of reflects in part what has happened in the French National Assembly, not with the left. The left won big in France. They didn't win big in Europe. Macron himself is a really unpopular character in France. Like the phrase that they all use, they call him the Macroniste policies, and they hate the Macroniste policies. You know, it might seem ludicrous to Irish listeners, but in France, they're trying to raise the pension age from 62 to 64, which is just, it's absolutely, you know, so unpopular. And it's one of the policies that the right party, the Rassemblement National of Marine Le Pen, is dead set against. Her kind of program for the budget, her asks on the budget, were very much about pensions and giving back money to pensioners. She also wanted, you know, electricity taxes to be lowered. So it's just a very strange time, and it's a really interesting time for Macron to be putting on this big show, to, you know, be unveiling Notre Dame, this big, you know, huge amounts of money pumped into this thing, and he's effectively, you know, a president without any power.
Sarah, it's very difficult to predict where this is going to go or where it's going to end. It'll probably trundle on for a while. But that question of downgrading the second biggest economy in the Eurozone, and do you think that there's a risk there for France being downgraded by some of those agencies?
There is a risk. A couple of the agencies have already put France on notice where they've said the outlook is negative. They haven't downgraded the debt yet. I think they're waiting to see what will happen in the next few days and weeks, whether Macron can actually manage to get a prime minister in place and what happens with the budget. Because a downgrade would be extremely bad news, not only for France, but for the euro. And I think it's certainly something EU officials are on watch, put it that way. They don't want to down talk the French government or the French economy more than they need to. But France doesn't have a lot of room for maneuver. You know, some EU officials here, the French budget has to be within EU rules. And the EU has already approved the budget of that Barnier put forward. And they're basically saying, you know, those are the parameters. Mm-hmm. You can tweak a few things, but you kind of have to stick to the same recipe. So it's unclear exactly what new measures a new prime minister could bring in that would satisfy both sides of the house.
Well, certainly all eyes are going to be on them for the next couple of weeks. Look, Sarah, it's a very movable feast, a complicated situation. And thank you very much for taking the time to come along today and explain it all to us. But for now, we're going to have to leave it there. That's Sarah Collins, Brussels correspondent with the Business Post. Sarah, thank you.
Thank you.
After the break, Mick Clifford takes us through the history of coalition governments in Ireland. So join us for that. Welcome back to News Talks Taking Stock. I'm Mandy Johnston. Now, with one coalition on the way out and another one beginning to form in front of us, I wanted today to look at some of the coalitions from the past. Did they work? Were the junior partners always doomed? And can we learn anything from their successes or failure? Well, there was really only one person I could ask to help me do this. And Mick Clifford, special correspondent with the Irish Examiner even, is on the line and he joins me now. Mick, you're very welcome.
Thanks, Mandy.
Well, they've had lots of different names over the years: coalition governments, inter-party governments, the governments of Ireland, rainbow governments. We've had the lot. But like, where did they start? When did they start? And why did they start in Ireland?
Well, I suppose the first one was back in 1948, Mandy, which came about largely, I think, because since 1932, Fianna Fáil had been in power. And it was a collection of different elements that were not Fianna Fáil that came together to put someone different into power. And this included Fine Gael, I think Labour. And Fine Gael had been led by Richard Mulcahy at the time. But he was unacceptable to some of the other elements of the coalition on the basis of his role in the Civil War some 26 years earlier, when he was part of the executive that had effectively sanctioned the executions, as they came to be known. And there's dispute on whether it was 77 or 81 specifically. But, you know, that had always hung over him, and therefore that was unacceptable to some of the others, who included Sean McBride, of course, who had been on the Republican side in the Civil War. So Mulcahy stepped aside and John A. Costello as the Taoiseach. Now, I suppose one of the things that coalition was remembered for was Noel Brown's attempt to bring in the mother and baby scheme, which was vehemently opposed by the Catholic Church, and it should also be noted and is often forgotten, also the senior medical consultants. And that ended up, Noel Brown, I think, ended up leaving, and that ended up after a while. But that was the first one. And thereafter, I suppose it's fair to say, all the way up until the 90s, the coalitions we had in the likes of the 70s and 80s were both Fine Gael and Labour. Now, you know, a bit unusual to the extent that Fine Gael, I'd say, would be perceived as being to the right of Fianna Fáil, Labour to the left. So again, you were really talking about anyone but Fianna Fáil kind of coalition in both those instances.
It's just so fascinating because we tend to think of coalitions as a product of modern politics, and of course it's not, but we're almost having a similar type debate now that they were having back in the 40s, where it was because it, you know, there was one party who was completely isolated, and as you say, anybody but Fianna Fáil, and now we have a kind of anybody but Sinn Féin, and all that left fragmentation is kind of floating around. But I suppose, yeah, the other thing that strikes you about the coalition governments or inter-party governments up until the 90s is they were all of a non-Fianna Fáil nature. And then, of course, we had the Charlie Haughey era where he finally conceded to coalition government. Maybe talk us through the background to that and why that was such a big deal at the time.
Yeah, I suppose just before that, the other thing that, I don't know, older people as old as myself, Mandy, to put it that way, might remember, I was a very small boy at the time, but I do remember the coalition of the 70s, Fine Gael and Labour. What that was noted for on one level was the satire that was in Hall's Pictorial Weekly, where Eamon Morrissey, the actor, played a character in it, Richie Roon.
Oh, this is Ballymagash, is it?
On Richie Ryan, the Minister for Finance. And Richie Roon was sitting shivering in an office wearing not much more than a string vest and a hat. and it looked like there was no electricity there or any central heating or anything, and he was shivering and talking to the nation about how everything was heading down the Swanee. And some people said that, you know, and it was brilliant comedy at the time, satire even, but some people said that that definitely impacted on the electorate in 1977 when that coalition came to an end to be replaced by Jack Lynch's Fianna Fáil. And then in the 80s, one of the notable features that apparently emerged out of that was the length of time the cabinet meetings went on. And that was largely attributable to the Taoiseach of that coalition, Garrett Fitzgerald, who, let me put it this way, I don't think anybody would suggest that he was a man of shorthand. And that appeared to apply to his cabinet meetings. He used to write a column as well in the Irish Times. And I always remember, whereas obviously a man of huge intellect, but when you'd start one of his sentences, sometimes by the time you got to the end of it, you weren't sure where exactly the start had been. So he tended not to be someone for shorthand in any way. But as you say, the 80s came along. Fianna Fáil, Charlie Hayes, Fianna Fáil in 87. He called a snap election in 89, thinking he was going to get an overall majority. It didn't happen. He had to go in with the Progressive Democrats, which had formed as a breakaway from Fianna Fáil some 4 years earlier, led by Desi O'Malley. That went on. Then, of course, Charlie Haughey, he retired, stroke resigned after a number of controversies. Albert Reynolds took over for him. And that coalition then hit the skids because there was a dispute between the two principals, Albert and Desi O'Malley, over evidence to the Beef Tribunal. And neither individual would be somebody who could be described politically anyway as very easygoing. So egos got in the way there. They went to the country and... then in out of that election came the next coalition, which was Fianna Fáil and Labour. Now, that would have been a very interesting one had it survived. But again, you had principals in Albert Reynolds and Dick Spring, who would not be the most laid-back characters in politics, both people of serious ability, no question. But one of the interesting things there was, again, the Beef Tribunal report, which became a huge thing, was issued during that government. And the thing that happened there was the night it was issued, by all accounts, Albert Reynolds and some of those around him, they got their hands on the first hard copy of the report. Remember, this is a time when we didn't have online or anything. And they locked doors in government buildings to ensure that they'd be able to read it and therefore see how bad or good it was in terms of how they were reflected before Dick Spring could come along with his people and read it. So that was the night they were locked out. But that inevitably also came to a bad end over, I think it was, issues around a paedophile priest, Brendan Smith, and whether or not he'd been okayed. And in the end, Albert had to resign from that. And there was another statement from that time was from Rory Quinn, who said at one stage, allegedly anyway, that they entered the office of Albert and said, "We've come for a head." So, and then out of that came the Rainbow Coalition.
Yeah, I mean, there's a couple of things in that, Mick. First of all, those coalitions in the 80s and then even the Gareth Fitzgerald one, the Haughey one and Albert Reynolds, like they're relatively short compared to what we're used to now, like 3 years, 1 year. The drama, I suppose, around the relationships was a lot more volatile, it certainly seems to me. Was there a sense now when you're looking at... you're looking back, and obviously you would have covered a lot of this, I guess, at the time in those Haughey Albert Reynolds one, that things have become very anodyne in politics now.
Yeah, I suppose, you know, you're a lot of anodyne in one way, but perhaps one might use the word sane in another sense. Mm. But you had a lot of big characters, you had a lot of conflict, and I suppose you had a lot of people, you know, not being completely armed to deal with the kind of change that was coming along to the whole political culture here, the likes of Charlie Hyde and Albert and all that sort of thing. And I suppose, you know, when you talk about the modern way and how people get on better. To be fair, the person who kind of ushered in that type of coalition was John Bruton in the Rainbow Coalition.
And because Bruton that was quite a complex mix of parties at a very difficult time, and you had lots going on, like the peace process was just getting up and running and the country was starting to do well. Maybe just give us a flavour of why that kind of mix of those three parties was unusual, to say the least.
Yeah, well, you see, back in 92, when it ultimately became Labour and Fianna Fáil, there'd been various talks, very similar to what's going on. Well, no, sorry, not as similar now, because now they're all talking, but the numbers don't add up, apart from Fianna Fáil, Fine Gael. But at that time, there was various talks going on, and John Bruton, who was head of Fine Gael, said he would not be going in with Democratic Left, as they were. Now, they subsequently merged, of course, with Labour. But he said he wouldn't go in with them. They were too far left for him. So Dick Spring and Labour walked away from Bruton, and they ended up going in with Fianna Fáil. Then when that came a cropper 2 years later, John Bruton had obviously softened, and he said, OK, he would go in with them. And he did go in them. And everybody thought, you know, this was a recipe for further conflict, but quite the opposite. And Bruton was very much credited with steering that ship and bringing those kind of disparate elements together. And he got on very well, by all accounts, particularly even with Pronchias de Rossa, who was the leader of Democratic Left, and with Dick Spring. And they operated very well, and they went into the 97 election. And, you know, there might have been some strategic issues that they didn't get right there one way or the other. It was Bertie Ahern who merged from that with the next coalition, which, of course, was with the Progressive Democrats. And, you know, Bertie Ahern, to be fair to him, was a man who had a practiced skill at getting on with people and had that ability to show anybody, potential opponent, to give them something more in order to smooth passage and what have you. So he went in with Mary Harney and the Progressive Democrats. And I think you'd be pretty familiar with that coalition yourself, Mandy.
Yep, indeed. Yeah, I was but a young girl working there for them in the Fianna Fáil press office and when they won that election. And, you know, I have to say, like, at that time, even the coalition government, the Progressive Democrats, when you got into government, it didn't feel like, you know, it was going to be something that was very stable. And you'll remember the first couple of months of that were particularly rocky, you know. So it was very novel moving from opposition into government and trying to learn how to work with the structures of the state. That's another part of coalition governments that I think people don't really get an insight into, Mick. Like, how do they function? Like, how do they operate on a day-to-day basis when you're kind of in there trying to keep those parties together? What do the leaders have to do?
Yeah, well, I mean, it was the advent of coalitions that really brought about this concept of programme managers, who were effectively political appointees who were there to liaise between the permanent government and the political government on behalf of their party and their leaders. And I think they're kind of the middle people, effectively. They smooth things up. They meet regularly before the party leaders would meet and decide what's on the agenda. And they're there as a form of ensuring that any potential conflict between parties can be smoothed out before it arises. So they're very much have become part of the furniture now. And I suppose you just combine that with the personalities of the leaders themselves and their capacity to get on, and particularly as which I think is a great capacity, and Bertie Ahern, to be fair to him, was very good at it, that ability to suppress egos and to be able to view the bigger picture.
The advent of those, you know, programme managers, I think Greg Sparks, and it was Labour who actually introduced that system, that certainly did add to the professionalisation of that relationship between political parties. Look, as you kind of then move on, I suppose you see that coalition government has become a more staple part of Irish politics and the way we do our business. Is that the same all over Europe? Are we an outlier? Why do you think that that's happening? And is it something different here?
Yeah, it's not, I mean, if anything, we're late to the party. I mean, the UK to some extent is an exception in that respect, in that you have the two big parties, the Conservatives and Labour, and they're very definitely left or right, wherever the centre may lie. But in a lot of Western European countries, you're talking about coalitions. And I suppose, you know, in a way, it's inevitable the way politics has evolved here. You get into the 90s and a post-Catholic society, and more of alignment along left-right. And then particularly the left in this country tends to be fragmented. Mm. I mean, you know, the famous Brendan Behan saying the first item on the agenda of any, I'm not sure did he say left, but any political organization is the split. So, you know, you therefore are going to have smaller entities individually, and it's a question of them coming together. So from that point of view, a large number of parties and therefore coalitions become par for the course, effectively. Mm. And that's how it has evolved now. And that's how it's very difficult to see it being anything but that into the foreseeable future.
Mick, listen, I could probably stay and talk to you about this for another hour. It's a fascinating insight, and it really only brought us up to 1997. And I'm sure there's more shenanigans to watch over the coming weeks ahead. And we hope you'll come back to us at some point. But for now, we'll have to leave it there. That was Mick Clifford, Special Correspondent for the Irish Examiner. Mick, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks, Manny.
Well, that's it for this episode of Taking Stock. Just a reminder that while we broadcast at this time on Sunday mornings, we're always available as a podcast first on Friday mornings on the News Talk app or wherever you get your podcasts from. My thanks, as always, to all of today's guests for their very valuable time and insights. The producer of Taking Stock was Simon Keane. Stephen Daunt was on research, and Hugo De Silva Scott was on sound. If you have any comments on any of today's items, please do get in touch with us on our email, which is takingstock@newstalk.com. Anton Savage is coming up next with all of your Sunday newspapers and lots, lots more. But for now, from Taking Stock with me, Mandy Johnston, thank you very much for listening and enjoy the rest of your day.
Taking Stock with Mandy Johnston, Sunday morning at 9.
Brought to you by PwC
on News Talk.